The singer Billie Holiday was only 44 years old when she died in 1959, and people still speak of her in terms reserved for few other singers. Billie Holiday just had a way of delivering a song that was unlike anyone else's. It's not a biography in the traditional sense, but there's a new book about Billie Holiday and her influences. It's called Religion Around Billie Holiday. It is the work of Tracy Fessenden, who's a professor in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at Arizona State University. Tracy's previous book is Culture and Redemption, Religion, the Secular, and American Literature. Tracy Fessenden, thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you, Jeff. It's delightful to be here.
So there's a whole series, I noticed, or at least the three so far, of religion around books. Can you give us a sketch of the series?
Yes. It's the brainchild of a colleague and friend of mine named Peter Kaufman, who is an historian of European Christianity and had the, I think, the brilliant idea to foreground a number of iconic figures by talking about or trying to apprehend the religion around those figures. And the premise is that we can learn something important about icons in the arts, particularly by thinking about the way in which they navigated the religious currents around them. So the focus is not on their particular religiosity, but how they dealt with religion in the environment in which they moved and how that might have shaped them, how they might have resisted it, how they might have incorporated it or otherwise responded to it. So the previous books in the series are Religion Around William Shakespeare and Religion Around Emily Dickinson. My book is Religion Around Billie Holiday. And what's very interesting, Jeff, is that the books and the works are focused largely on music. We have one in the works on Bob Dylan, another on Bob Marley. I believe there's a book on Bono being written now. And so I think that there's something important about sound that lends itself to this kind of treatment.
That's fascinating stuff, too, when you think about the fact that even people who insist, I am not religious, I have never been religious, they still are products of the culture in which they grew up. And if there's religion in that culture, it could be an influence.
Yes. I tell my students all the time that even if they're not religious, they are products of their environment, and there's religion all around them that they need to know something about in order to navigate. And so this the opportunity to write for this series put that conviction to the test.
I love the line that you repeat here about writing about music is like dancing about architecture.
So, and why not, right?
Sure, right. So how did you approach the book? I mean,
well, it was an enormous privilege to be able to write this book. And, you know, choosing a subject for a biographical study is, it's a little like choosing a partner. You're going to be living with this person for a long time, right. And you want to make sure the love is real. So a lot of the work I did didn't feel like work at all. It was really just listening. And I had the immense good fortune to be able to listen to Billie Holiday for years on end. I didn't know when I started the book anything about her own religious life because, of course, I was interested in her religious environment. But I did discover so many fascinating parts of her story that I think are neglected because we tend not to talk about religion in general kinds of terms. And so the fact that she spent time as a child in a convent was particularly interesting to me. Her relationship to what we might think of as a black church sound that we associate, say, with Aretha Franklin or Mahalia Jackson is quite unique because that was not her background. She did not come up in one of the great black Protestant churches in the South. And she was, like many of her contemporaries, although I think she outshines all of them, a brilliant interpreter of the American Songbook, which, of course, is also a very Jewish American songbook. So many of our great composers and lyricists from the 20th century were Jewish immigrants from Eastern Europe or the sons and daughters of immigrants.
Let's rather than dance about architecture, let's hear a little of Billie Holiday.
And, okay.
So I want to hear a little bit of God Bless the Child right here.
Money!
Billie Holiday and God Bless the Child. You describe that song in the book as a slightly subversive spiritual, Tracy. Why?
Well, it's interesting that she wrote the song with the help of a composer named Arthur Herzog. And when the sheet music was published, it was called A Spiritual in Swing. So it wasn't really a spiritual. It didn't exactly swing. But this was her way of, I think, putting her own distinctive spin on the tradition of the spirituals, which, as we know, was not her tradition because she did not come of age in a church where she would have heard the spirituals regularly. But it was also subversive in that it was an answer to a contentious relationship that she had with the great record producer John Hammond, who was a larger-than-life figure, created so much of the music that we associate with the 20th century, from artists from Bessie Smith to Bruce Springsteen, literally. He claimed to have discovered them all, and he wasn't exaggerating too much when he said that. But he was of course larger than life figure, larger than life ego, and he was white, and he saw his relationship to black artists in I think a very paternalistic way, and he had the means, he had the wherewithal to bring all kinds of fabulous artists to Carnegie Hall in 1938 for a concert that he called From Spirituals to Swing. And it was an amazing concert. He included Sister Rosetta Tharpe, the Golden Gate Quartet, all the way up to Count Basie. Lester Young was there. But he had a very particular narrative into which he sought to fit African-American music. And it wasn't Billie Holiday's narrative. And she walked out of the concert, essentially, didn't feel that he was paying her enough, and she was right about that. So she came back with this song, God Bless the Child, about having her own money, about having her own wherewithal, and it was a little bit of a snub to John Hammond.
All right, we'll pick up the discussion about Billie Holiday with Tracy Fezzenden in 1 minute here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the late, great Billie Holiday. Gone, but certainly not forgotten. She died in 1959 at age 44, way too young in many people's minds, but she had left a great record of success as a singer, a little less success perhaps in her personal life, which is why she died at age 44 in 1959. We are looking more at the cultural surroundings of Billie Holiday with Tracy Fezzenden from Arizona State University, who's written a book called Religion Around Billie Holiday, and it looks at the influences she might have picked up from religion around her in the time of her work. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So we mentioned that Billie Holiday did not come from the Southern Protestant tradition, but she was around Catholics a lot when she was growing up, and not necessarily voluntarily. Can you explain that, Tracy?
Yes. She was sent twice to a convent reform school in Baltimore. It was called the House of the Good Shepherd for Colored Girls. Her mother had also lived at the House of the Good Shepherd for Colored Girls, and it was a place where girls and young women who were basically street kids were not cared for, didn't have proper guardians, or in some cases had been caught up in prostitution or sex trafficking, were sent for their own protection, as it was seen, and given an education, given shelter and food and clothing and so on, cared for by nuns for the time for the duration of their stay. And Billie Holiday was sent twice, once as a street kid, a kid without proper guardianship, and a second time when she was picked up at the home of a couple who were trafficking young girls. And this was a life that she was very intimately acquainted with. When she was not at the House of the Good Shepherd, she seems to have lived with a number of different mentors who were eager to exploit her beauty, her singing talent, and put her to work in good time houses as both an entertainer and very probably also as a prostitute. So at the House of the Good Shepherd, she was trained in the she was given a very Catholic formation. She received the sacraments. She sang a Catholic Mass every morning, 6 o'clock, learned to sing in the style of Gregorian chant, which had recently been renewed and revived at the end of the 19th century in ways that sound very modern to us. And I think that this is where she developed her distinctive singing style.
We actually have John Baxter, our senior producer at The Exchange, did a little a mashup here. We took a Gregorian chant and mixed it up with a Billie Holiday song. So let's hear. We can hear the influence
wonderful.
Here.
Darling, I hope that my dream never haunted you. My heart is telling you how much I wanted you. Gloomy Sunday.
So, Tracy, let's talk about the approach that Billie Holiday is taking there as we go back to the Gregorian chant sound. She was famous, it sounds like, for not hitting the note on the head.
That's right. That's right. Thank you so much to your producer. That is just gorgeous, that juxtaposition.
So, but this is something that Gregorian chant, you say, had changed to by the time that Billie was forced
yes,
to sing?
Yes. There was an effort at the end of the 19th century among a group of monks in France, at the Solesmes Monastery in France, to revive the great tradition of Gregorian chant, which they, under the direction of the Vatican, saw as having fallen into disrepair. That is, Gregorian chant in the 17th and 18th centuries and into the 19th century had been scored in ways that made it sound, I guess, sort of baroque, made it sound familiar to European ears in those centuries, but seemed to have drifted far from the way in which these monks and these experts in liturgical music assumed that chant had been sung in, say, the 12th century. And, of course, there are no recordings from that period. But the monks at Solesmes Abbey undertook a massive project of restoration or revival, what they saw as the original form or the original purity of chant that they were seeking to recover. And what they urged was that chant be sung in a minimalist melodic register, but with a very a different relationship to the melody, to metered time. The choir master at Solesmes said that the metered time, that time should become a thing of the spirit, and that the voice should, in a sense, leap over the notes, drift between the notes, sing in the manner of ordinary speech with the cadences and rhythms of ordinary speech, voicing the notes quickly and lightly in unpredictable groups of two and three, which sounds to me like what Billie Holiday certainly did.
Did she ever explicitly acknowledge that influence?
You know, she never did. She was not a self-chronicler. She didn't keep a diary or a journal. But I think that her formation, her immersion in this sound at a very important moment in the church's recovery of this liturgical music certainly went to her formation as much, I think, as Charlie Parker's Summer in the Woodshed playing scales. We would never overlook that kind of discipline, I think, in a Charlie Parker, but in Billie Holiday, when people look at her life, this is a part of her life that tends to be overlooked. One of the very interesting things about this period as well for Billie Holiday is that the Pope at the time said that girls and women couldn't sing the Mass because the singing of the Mass was a liturgical function and that only priests could fulfill that role. But this was a moment where Catholic churches had a sort of a grassroots rebellion against what the Vatican was recommending and said, especially at girls' schools, said, absolutely not, we are still going to sing and we're going to teach our pupils to sing. So there was something a little bit rebellious about being trained in this tradition at the time that she was and in this musical tradition. The chaplain at the House of the Good Shepherd who baptized her was also a choir director. He was the author of a book on vocal technique. So he took this very, very seriously. And I think that this is a part of her education that we can learn to hear when we do the kinds of things like you've just done, listening to her sing alongside some of these forms of chant that she was exposed to.
Yeah, thanks again to John Baxter for assembling that mashup. Religion Around Billie Holiday is the book by Tracy Fezzenden we're discussing here on the Jefferson Exchange. Spirituals with a Hangover is a term you mentioned in the book. It's a great musical picture. To what does it refer?
It refers to blues, that is, I think, a wonderful description of the relationship between blues and church sounds, the kinds of church sounds that gave rise to the blues. You know, we have a habit of thinking of blues and gospel as opposites, or blues and religious life as opposites, that the blues were the devil's music, church sounds were a way of communing with the divine, but I think that blues very much also come out of a black church tradition, and, one a bit of evidence in support of that view is that so many of the great blues singers come out of church backgrounds, and many of them returned to the church when they gave up their careers in blues.
You mentioned that John Hammond had organized a concert called From Spirituals to Swing, and I wonder if the term was in use before he used it for the concert.
The term spirituals and from spirituals to swing,
yes.
Or well, I don't see it before that concert. He was tracing a what he saw as a progression or a form of a development in black music. And actually, he started the concert with a recording of what he called wild African chanting that had been recorded on an anthropological expedition. And so he had this notion that black music starts it from this very primal source, and spirituals are closest to that of American black music, but that spirituals would then build successively through different phases of development musically, aesthetically, different phases of autonomy in African American life, and yield at the end what we have by the late 30s as swing. So I haven't heard that progression or that relationship discussed in quite that way before the Spirituals to Swing concert.
But was this a conscious shove by him to sort of get black sounds into swing to make them mainstream and ultimately build a bigger audience?
Well, that's a good point. Of course, there were black swing artists, and bands were largely segregated. But even Billie Holiday in the late 30s was singing with Artie Shaw, one of the only black singers to sing with a white band. So there were black swing artists. He was interested in showing that that American popular music had an African American pedigree, that we couldn't understand music in the late 30s without understanding something about the development of African American music. But as I said earlier, his view was very paternalistic, and he almost slotted his performers into a kind of living diorama, a kind of graded a performance of levels through which African American music would pass. And it wasn't, I think, the way that the performers themselves understood their music. But Hammond, I think, wanted to show that he understood the vast coherence of the music that he was presenting.
Tracy Fezzenden is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book is called Religion Around Billie Holiday, one of a series of books about religion around certain people in the popular culture. Billie Holiday is certainly a major figure in the popular culture. Even though she's been dead since 1959, we still talk about her like she's still very much here, and her music's still very much around us. You can join the conversation on the Exchange, 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We're talking about Billie Holiday singing with some of the big swing bands. You'll probably notice Benny Goodman's clarinet in here. This is Billie Holiday singing I Wished on the Moon.
I look for every loveliness. It all came true. I wished on the moon for you.
All very mainstreamy kind of sounding stuff. You mentioned that Billie Holiday did not come from a tradition of spirituals from a Protestant church in the South. Did have a Catholic background. Haven't really covered the blues part of this. Even she called her autobiography Lady Sings the Blues, but she didn't really think of herself as a blues singer, did she?
No, she didn't. And the title of the autobiography, Lady Sings the Blues, was not her idea. She wanted to call it Bitter Crop, which is, as some of your listeners may know, the final syllables of the song Strange Fruit. She could, of course, sing the blues like no one else. She was a wonderful interpreter of the blues. But it was also the case that blues was a kind of default category for African-American singers during the decades of her career, much as until fairly recently we would see black artists on what were called the R&B charts, the rhythm and blues charts. That was a sort of a holdover from the catch-all category of blues. Prior to blues being a default category for black singers, we had something called race records, which were recorded for black audiences and distributed to black audiences. And then white audiences or largely white audiences got hold of them and did some other things with that music. But Billie Holiday had a vast range. You played Gloomy Sunday a few minutes ago. Others of her songs were very artistic kinds of songs. Strange Fruit is a very, we would call it an art song. It's composed all the way through. She sang very light, popular ballads from Tin Pan Alley, show tunes. She had a vast range, and blues were only a part of it.
Does she have I think I know the answer to this question. It's Strange Fruit. So we have it. We have that queued up, too. So let's hear a bit of Strange Fruit.
Black body swinging in the southern breeze. Strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees.
That is a song that I heard of before I heard, and it's just amazing in what it did and what it said. And how big a part did Billie Holiday have in the creation of the song?
That you're absolutely right. I mean, that song is haunting and remains so. She sang it for the first time at the end of 1938. It had been brought to her by the proprietor of a new nightclub, Cafe Society, which was in Greenwich Village and which was innovative in that it included white and black acts, white and black audiences. And the poem, it started as a poem. It had been written by a Jewish labor activist and high school teacher named Abel Meeropol. And he was an absolutely extraordinary figure, did all kinds of activism. He wrote poetry. He wrote songs. He performed. When Ethel and Julius Rosenberg were executed, he adopted their children, even though he didn't know the Rosenbergs. So he was just a very incredibly impressive figure. He gave the song to Billie Holiday, or gave it to the proprietor of Cafe Society. Billie Holiday looked at it, and she didn't know quite what to do with it, but she and her accompanist sat down, and they worked out an arrangement of the song. And she performed it to stunned audiences and continued to do so for the remainder of her career. She would usually end a set with Strange Fruit. But it was so arresting. It was not a song that even the black press quite knew how to respond to, and there's very little press attention to that song in the years after its release. John Hammond refused to record it on Columbia Records, and Meeropol and Holiday came to odds in subsequent years over her role in creating the song. He wanted to be known as he was, as the composer of the song, words and music. And of course, as your listeners know, any song that Billie Holiday sings is one that she puts her distinctive stamp on. So the impression that she had had a hand in the song was not one that she sought to correct. She and Meeropol never quite agreed on this. And I think that the real difference that they had between them about Strange Fruit was what the song was intended to do. Meeropol was so invested in a progressive political culture. He saw this as a backward glance at the South, a backward glance at lynching. And for Billie Holiday, Strange Fruit was about the reality of African-American life right now.
Contemporary,
right as she was singing the song. Yes, yes.
So if even the African American newspapers wouldn't touch any discussion of it, was there any response really from the broader culture? You mentioned it wasn't recorded, so it sounds like it took a while for people to even learn about the song.
Well, it was recorded in 1939. Columbia Records refused to record it, but she did go to another label to record the song. There was a write-up in the New York Post, actually, by a columnist named Sam Grafton, who was kind of a conservative. He had a column called "I'd Rather Be Right," which was sort of a right-wing column, but he was just floored by the song, absolutely floored by the song. And he said if the movement for Negro rights, as I think you called it then, you know, ever had its national anthem, this is it. Black papers were a little bit more reticent because African-American papers were devoted to creating a kind of black quotidian, as my colleague Matt Delmont calls it. They wanted black news to be about things other than violence, other than trauma, and so they reported on weddings, graduations, victories. And so Strange Fruit was something that was hard to bring into this culture of reporting.
It's an amazing song and bears listening to all the way through. We're talking about Billie Holiday here on the Jefferson Exchange with Tracy Fessenden, who wrote a book about her. Tracy is at Arizona State University, and she's written a book called Religion Around Billie Holiday. We'll come back and talk more about Billie Holiday and her contemporaries and the contemporary cultural strains that may have found their way into Billie Holiday's way of interpreting music. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Tracy Fessenden and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Tracy Fessenden, who is a professor in the School of Historical, Philosophical, and Religious Studies at Arizona State University. She has written a book in the Religion Around series, which looks at the religious influences on people in culture. And this one's about Billie Holiday. Religion Around Billie Holiday is the book. We're talking about the famous singer who died at age 44 in 1959 and is still talked about constantly today. Phone number, if you'd like to join the conversation on the exchange, is 800-838-3760. Email address, jx@jeffnet.org. He got off the line, but John in Ashland had a question about the relationship between Billie Holiday and Lester Young, I guess the president of jazz.
Yes. What a relationship that was. Lester Young, of course, had his own distinctive sound and had a life that, like Billie Holiday's, was governed, I think, by a sense of artistic calling and a sensibility that was very unusual, not easily assimilated into the life of a successful musical artist. And like Billie Holiday, Lester Young was someone who found himself in poverty, found himself battling with addiction, was misused by many in the music industry. He and Billie Holiday were soulmates. I would say they were certainly musical lovers, if we can put it in those terms. They listened to one another, heard things in one another that they could each respond to. It's not clear that they ever had a romantic relationship, but they were lovers in every other way. And they both died young, within a few months of one another. It said that in the end, they both listened to Billie Holiday records where they lived alone in their apartments. He would listen to hear her voice, and she would listen to hear his horn. They made more records together than Billie Holiday made with any other of her accompanists. So certainly her sound is very much a sound that Lester Young contributed to, and vice versa.
I just noticed that fact, too, that they both died within a few months of each other in 1959.
Yes.
And not very old. He was, I think, 50.
No.
So, yeah.
No, that's true.
You were talking about the context of Strange Fruit, that the person who wrote the words looked at it as a backwards look at what he thought was a South going out of that kind of business. But for Billie Holiday, it was a very contemporary kind of thing. And there are other things that were contemporary to the African-American experience in her time, like the Double V for Victory campaign during World War II, which I didn't know about until the last year or so. What was that all about?
Yes, well, the Double V campaign came about as a result of a letter that was written to the Pittsburgh Courier, the nation's largest African-American newspaper. And the letter was written by a young black soldier who was responding to the recent lynching of a uniformed black soldier at Fort Benning, who had been lynched before going overseas. And the young letter writer said, should I die to live half free for my country? If I'm going to go overseas, put my life on the line, then I want to know that I'm fighting for everyone's freedom, including my own. And so let's think of the victory we seek in the Second World War as a double victory, not just the victory of freedom in the world, but the victory of freedom for African Americans at home. So when we fight, we are fighting for African American rights as well as for the victory of Allied powers abroad. So this, of course, struck a chord and created all kinds of interest, investment, excitement. The Pittsburgh Courier, the newspaper, really whipped up this excitement because it drove their circulation, drove their sales, and so they had all kinds of contests. Tell us what the Double V means to you. Create a Double V hairdo. Show us your Double Victory garden. And so there was a lot of excitement over this idea, and a number of black churches got in on the Double V idea and pronounced Easter Sunday, 1942, Double V Day, and showed a picture. The Courier showed a picture of the risen Christ with a V in each hand. But you know, looking back, it was a very idealistic movement, and it was not one, I think, that bore the fruits that we would have wanted to see until much later, if at all. Black soldiers were segregated in Jim Crow barracks. They returned, in many cases, to diminished liberties. Lester Young's experience in war was a case in point. He was sent to a training camp in Georgia. He copped to a marijuana charge. He thought he could get a dishonorable discharge and just go back to playing his horn. And instead, he was sent to a military jail for a year. And when he came out, he was just never the same. So black soldiers didn't win the victory that they sought, even as they might have fought successfully abroad. And so Billie Holiday kept some distance from that optimism, that enthusiasm for black civil rights victories in the 40s. She was not much of a presence in wartime. Of course, a part of the American military strategy was to do a lot of cultural work to increase morale, they sent all kinds of musical artists and performers to entertain the troops. And Billie Holiday was not a very visible part of that effort, because I think it was hard for her to muster a kind of enthusiasm, a kind of sense that all of this would be getting better anytime soon.
So ultimately, how political was she in terms of being outspoken in ways other than her music about how she felt about the way the world was going?
You know, she wasn't terribly outspoken. I think, you know, we're tempted to see her as being very political, as being an activist, but she was really an artist. She was a musician. And even when she sang Strange Fruit, there was nothing in that song that suggested that that created a program for organizing or a platform for civil rights work. It was a witness to injustice and a witness to the horrific prejudice that she and other African Americans encountered every day. That, I think, spurred a great deal of activism and gave power to a particular black politics, but I'm not sure that she herself saw herself as a political figure or understood herself in those terms. Does not diminish her achievement at all in that arena, but she herself was not an activist, not someone who campaigned for change. She was a witness to the things that needed to change.
So not terribly political in the overt sense. And let's talk about what she said about her own religion, because this book is ultimately about the religion that was around her. What did she ever cop to in terms of belief or adherence or visits to church or any of that?
Well, she said a few things. She said that she walked out of the confessional as a young woman because the priest began to upbraid her from his side of the lattice about her sins. And she said, "You're a white man and you ain't God." And she stormed out of the confessional for good and said that she never went back. She did stay in touch with at least one of the nuns at the House of the Good Shepherd. She was also very good friends with a Catholic priest in Boston who was the chaplain at Boston University, had a jazz radio show. He was known as the jazz priest, Father Norman O'Connor, also wrote a column for the Boston Herald. And he hosted her when she was in the city, and he convinced her that she could live the life that she chose and still be a good Catholic. And she said that she wished that he were the Pope, because that was not a message that she heard often enough. When she died, her funeral was paid for by a wealthy Catholic layman who was a friend of the Catholic Worker Movement, Dorothy Day's Catholic Worker Movement, and it was a traditional Catholic funeral with a 12-voice Catholic choir that was conducted entirely in Latin and chanted in the way that she had learned to sing chant. She was buried in a Catholic cemetery with her mother in a grave alongside her mother, and her headstone reads "Hail Mary, full of grace." She prayed the rosary as an adult. She prayed to Saint Teresa in times of trouble. Teresa of Lisieux, a great French saint, was canonized during Billie Holiday's first tenure at the House of the Good Shepherd, and she recalled taking the name Teresa as her own name when she entered the House of the Good Shepherd. It was customary for girls to choose the name of a saint that they would be known by during their stay. So she maintained certainly some connection to Catholicism, even if she was not herself what she would call a practicing Catholic. She described her mother as a Catholic who was always on her knees. That was not Billie Holiday's relationship to the Catholic Church. But certainly she maintained a Catholic identity that I think went very much to her own distinctive persona.
And you did mention earlier that through her time in the music business, extensive as it was, she was exposed to a lot of people of the Jewish faith. And there was a little oddball thing we picked up off of YouTube here, which is Billie Holiday singing "My Yiddish Mama."
Oh, great, great.
Mama, I long to kiss her ankle brow. It's too high.
It's too high, she says. It's obviously a practice session there, but that's an amazing bit of stuff there.
Yes, it is. And that song, I believe it's that recording, also shows up on a 2010 pressing of Jewish Classics that has the title Black Sabbath. So I'm afraid it gets lost in record stores because people wouldn't necessarily know that these were African-American artists singing Jewish songs. But, of course, most of the songs that African-American artists or any artist had to sing in the 30s and 40s were Jewish songs because they were churned out by this amazing culture of Jewish songwriting.
Irving Berlin being the one of the primary
Irving
examples,
Berlin, yeah. The Gershwins, Rodgers and Hart, Rodgers and Hammerstein. I mean, the list goes on and on. And so, you know, when Holiday sings "My Yiddish Mommy," I think that there's something in that song. She's at the home of her friend Bill Dufty, who was Catholic. He was her co-writer on "Lady Sings the Blues," but he was married to a Jewish woman. And she was singing at that moment to their son, Bevan Dufty, who is now the BART commissioner in San Francisco. He was a great source for me on this book. But I think she's voicing a kind of debt to the Jewish songwriting tradition when she talks about her Yiddish mommy, her Yiddish nurture, her Jewish nurture, in much the same way that Louis Armstrong described being taken in by a Jewish family as a child in New Orleans, and how it was the Jewish family who taught him to sing and who taught him who bought his first cornet and who exposed him to music. Armstrong's memory is a little bit jumbled up because he says that this Jewish family taught him Irving Berlin's Russian Lullaby, which wasn't even written for 20 years after, until 20 years after the setting of his reminiscences. But I think he's also voicing a debt to Jewish song and Jewish songwriting culture in much the same way that Billie Holiday is in that clip.
That's impressive. The process of trying to dig into the life, and more importantly in this case, the influences of Billie Holiday, a figure who lived in a mostly pre-television and certainly pre-TMZ time. I mean, there's a lot of myth that collects around a person, and I wonder what were some of the ones that you were able to disabuse people of through the writing of the book.
Well, yeah, there certainly are many, many Billie Holiday myths, and I'm not so concerned to disabuse people of those myths because I'm not sure I have access to the hard reality behind the myth. I also know that Billie Holiday herself was very shaped by myths and the stories that she learned in the convent about the great Catholic women saints particularly, and that she saw her life, I believe, in sort of mythic terms. So to take, for example, the myth that she was a suffering artist or that she was a natural, those are, I think, characters in a sense that she performed and that were true to her experience in some way. So there's a very vigorous industry, I think, of Billie Holiday listenership, fandom, that wants to say that she was not simply a suffering artist, that she was an incredibly disciplined artist, that she maintained control of her sound as few musical artists did in that period, that she had all kinds of difficulties to contend with, and even so managed to create this incredible body of work. To that I say, yes, absolutely, that is absolutely the case. But I think it is also the case that she did put into her sound a relationship to suffering that was very intentional and that did express something about her life. And so to say that that was all an act and had nothing to do with who she really was, I think is wrong. Similarly, you know, this notion that she was a natural, that she was self-taught, we don't want to endorse the view that is so common that African-American artists simply are musical. She was incredibly disciplined, but there was also something in her voice that she wanted to convey, a kind of naturalness that she sought to convey.
There is a lot of interesting stuff in the book, particularly when you look at the influences of anybody in any time and consider what the influences were on Billie Holiday. The book is called Religion Around Billie Holiday, one in a series of Religion Around books. Tracy Fessenden from Arizona State University, the author and our guest. Tracy, thanks for joining us.
Steph, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure.
A pleasure to have you.